Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Mes chers compatriotes, la démocratie...
My dear compatriots, democracy has spoken, and the French people have placed the National Rally and its allies on top and have practically erased Macron's bloc.
France's far right wins the first round of voting in a snap election, followed closely by the left, trouncing President Emmanuel Macron's coalition. We'll go to Paris for the latest. Then power grab and a major ruling. The Supreme Court's conservative majority rules corporate interests can strip federal agencies of their authority to regulate public health, the environment, worker protection, food safety, and more. We'll get response from environmental justice advocate, former EPA administrator Mustafa Ali, and the nation's Elie Mystal. And we'll discuss today's highly anticipated ruling on former President Donald Trump's bid for immunity from his federal indictment for trying to subvert the 2020 election. We'll also look at how the publisher of The Washington Post allegedly helped cover up a scandal. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In France, the far right is at the gates of power after it won a significant lead in the first round of snap parliamentary elections Sunday, a blow to President Emmanuel Macron's Ensemble alliance, which is polling third. Marine Le Pen's anti-immigrant national rally bloc has so far clinched nearly 34% of the vote, while the new Popular Front, a coalition formed by leftist parties, came in a close second with nearly 28% of the vote. Sunday's election brought out the highest voter turnout in years as young French voters were urged to come out to defeat extremists. Macron stunned the country, calling for the snap elections following major losses in European Parliament elections last month to the far-right NR party. After headlines, we'll go to Paris for the latest. In the Gaza Strip, thousands of civilians remain trapped amidst heavy fighting in the Gaza city district of Shujaia, where Israeli tanks were seen advancing after another day of brutal Israeli attacks. Gaza's health ministry says at least 23 Palestinians were killed in the past day alone, bringing the death toll since the start of Israel's latest assault on Gaza to more than 37,900. In Gaza's Deir al-Balah neighborhood, survivors of an Israeli airstrike gathered at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital Saturday to mourn the dead. This is 10-year-old Bilal Abu Hassanian, whose family home was bombed by Israel last week.
I went to check out our rooftop, and they struck us. I was bombed. I flew off the rooftop and fell. When I fell, I was shattered. My grandfather started screaming. I went out to see what was happening. My grandfather was telling us that our home was bombed. When I heard the word bombed, I went to check the room where I had been sleeping. I found out that my mother and brother had been martyred.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian government media office says another journalist has been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza, the 153rd such deadly attack it's reported since October. Mohammed Mahmoud Abu Sharia died of wounds 2 days after an Israeli airstrike targeted his home in the Sabra neighborhood of Gaza City. In Israel, an estimated 130,000 protesters marched in Tel Aviv Saturday evening, demanding an immediate ceasefire deal in Gaza, a prisoner swap that would see all Israelis held hostage by Hamas released, and the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. This is Sneer Da'an, whose cousin is being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza.
The one thing standing between us and our loved ones is Netanyahu's stubborn insistence to not end this war as a part of a deal. The continuation of this war means the murder of the hostages by Israeli's government. The blood is on your hands.
Meanwhile, thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jewish men held protests over the weekend after Israel's high court lifted an exemption to mandatory military service for members of conservative religious groups. In Sudan, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group claims it's captured the city of Sinja, a key state capital in southeastern Sudan. Tens of thousands of residents fled the city ahead of the RSF's advance. Those who remain report RSF fighters have been seen widely looting homes and shops. Last week, the United Nations Hunger Monitor warned over 750,000 people in Sudan are facing catastrophic levels of extreme hunger, while more than 8 million face food shortages that could lead to malnutrition or even death. Hurricane Beryl is making landfall on the Windward Islands, with meteorologists warning the Category 3 storm will bring life-threatening winds and storm surge across southeastern Caribbean nations. Hurricane warnings were issued in Barbados, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, and Grenadine Islands, Grenada, and Tobago. Over the weekend, Beryl reached Category 4 status, becoming the earliest such Atlantic hurricane on record. It's being fueled by an unprecedented ocean heat wave driven by the climate crisis. The U.S. Supreme Court's conservative supermajority has struck down four decades of precedent, which established that judges should defer to federal agencies on interpreting a law if Congress did not specifically address the issue. On Friday, justices ruled 6-3 to overturn the legal precedent known as the Chevron Doctrine. Critics call the court's ruling a major power grab by corporate interests. Justice Elena Kagan wrote in dissent, quote, "In every sphere of current or future federal regulation, expect courts from now on to play a commanding role. It's not a role Congress has given them. It's a role this court has now claimed for itself, as well as other judges," unquote. In another 6-3 ruling on Friday, justices ruled local governments can criminalize sleeping and camping on public property, banning encampments of unhoused people. In a scathing dissent joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote for the minority, quote, "Sleep is a biological necessity, not a crime. For some people, sleeping outside is their only option. For people with no access to shelter, that punishes them for being homeless. That's unconscionable and unconstitutional," they said. We'll have more on the Supreme Court's rulings later in the broadcast. President Trump's former top political advisor is reporting to a federal prison today after he was found guilty of contempt of Congress for defying subpoenas related to the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. Steve Bannon is set to begin a four-month sentence after the Supreme Court declined Bannon's request that it intervene. Just last week, top congressional Republicans, led by House Speaker Mike Johnson, filed an amicus brief on Bannon's behalf, asking the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to keep him out of jail. Bannon still faces criminal charges in New York for allegedly defrauding donors to an anti-immigrant nonprofit called We Build the Wall, out of more than $15 million and for laundering the proceeds. Democratic leaders are defending President Biden after his disastrous debate against Donald Trump last week, when Biden appeared halting, disjointed, and often seemed to lose his train of thought. Prominent Democrats rejecting calls for the president to step aside include Biden's surrogates, Senators Raphael Warnock and Chris Coons, Congressmember Jim Clyburn, and Maryland Governor Wes Moore. Democratic strategist David Axelrod wrote, quote, "Unless the president himself decides to quit, which he won't, that issue is settled," unquote. This comes as a new CBS News poll finds 72% of registered U.S. voters believe Biden does not possess the mental and cognitive health required to be president. On Friday, the New York Times editorial board published an editorial titled, "To Serve His Country, President Biden Should Leave the Race." The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's editorial board similarly called on Biden to bow out. Meanwhile, Maryland Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin told MSNBC there are conversations among top Democrats about nominating someone other than Joe Biden at the Democratic National Convention in August.
We're having a serious conversation about what to do. One thing I can tell you is that regardless of what President Biden decides, our party is going to be unified, and our party also needs him at the very center of our deliberations and our campaign. And so whether he's the candidate or someone else is the candidate, he is going to be the keynote speaker at our convention.
In Iran, reformist candidate Masoud Pezeshkian will face off against conservative Saeed Jalili. in a runoff election set for July 5th after neither candidate received enough votes in a weekend poll to win the presidency outright. Fewer than 25 million Iranians voted in the contest to replace former President Ibrahim Raisi, who died in a helicopter crash in May. That's just 40% of eligible voters, the lowest turnout in any Iranian election since the 1979 revolution. Millions of people took to the streets of cities across the globe over the weekend to celebrate LGBTQ plus pride events. In Bogota, Colombia, thousands of pride participants marched against so-called conversion therapy, which aims to change a person's sexuality through interventions. A bill under consideration in Colombia's legislature would ban the practice, which has been described by a UN expert on sexual orientation as torture. In the Republic of Georgia, lawmakers have granted initial approval to several bills cracking down on LGBTQ plus rights, including bans on the so-called propaganda of same-sex relationships, gender reassignment surgery, and even the display of rainbow flags. The bills mirror anti-LGBTQ legislation passed by Russia. This is Tamar Jekeli, director of Tbilisi Pride in Georgia's capital city.
Pride march or pride events could no longer be held legally. So even though in the past, practically, we had difficulties holding this, now it's going to be illegal. And basically, if I want to hold a pride march or any demonstration, in fact, about LGBT rights, at first I will get fined, and then I might even face charges, like to go to prison.
Here in the United States, President Biden's pardoned thousands of U.S. military veterans convicted under laws banning gay sex under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. In a separate declaration, Biden described the anti-LGBTQ lavender scare that began in the 1950s as a, quote, shameful chapter in our nation's history, unquote. The White House says up to 10,000 LGBTQ plus federal employees were investigated and lost their jobs simply because of who they were and whom they loved. On Friday, President Biden flew to New York City, where he spoke at the opening ceremony of the newly constructed Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center. The memorial is built on the site of a gay and trans-friendly bar called the Stonewall Inn, which was raided by New York City police June 28, 1969. As officers began dragging some of the patrons out at the time, the community, led largely by trans women, fought back, sparking 3 days of rioting and resistance that launched the modern-day LGBTQ movement. This is President Biden.
55 years ago today, on this hallowed ground, a pivotal story for our nation unfolded. The soul of the nation was literally tested. That's not hyperbole. The soul of the nation was tested. And the heart of this movement was ignited, and the course of history has changed forever. Not just here, but I traveled around the world. They looked to us. They looked to us, and it's part of our foreign policy as well now.
As Biden addressed the Stonewall National Monument's grand opening, queer and trans activists held protests unfurling banners reading, "Queers to Biden, stop arming Israel." And from New York to Gaza, Stonewall was an intifada, unquote. Stonewall veteran and legendary trans activist Miss Major Griffin Gracie said in a statement, quote, "Stonewall was about kicking the cops out of our lives. Biden can't come here and pretend to support us while he drops bombs on people in Gaza. The girls and guys will keep on fighting, chanting, marching till every damn person is free, including Palestinians," they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in France, where the far right's at the gates of power as it holds a significant lead in the first round of snap parliamentary elections Sunday, a blow to President Emmanuel Macron's Ensemble Alliance, which polled third to the right and to the left. Marine Le Pen's anti-immigrant national rally and our bloc has so far clinched nearly 34% of the vote, while the New Popular Front, a coalition formed by leftist parties, came in second with about 28% of the vote. This is far-right leader Marine Le Pen.
My dear compatriots, democracy has spoken, and the French people have placed the National Rally and its allies on top and have practically erased Macron's bloc.
Meanwhile, hundreds of people took to the streets of Paris and other cities Sunday following news of the initial results. Protesters held signs that read, "Let's not leave France to the fascists," and "Enough of the Hatred Era."
Moi, ça m'inquiète personnellement parce que bon bah on voit.
It worries me personally because we see that the national rally are on top and it scares me. We don't see a vote coming for social rights. We don't see economic progress. We don't see immigration. It will worsen rights for LGBT, for women, abortion, medically assisted procreation. All of this will be swept away because it's the far right. We mustn't forget that.
Sunday's election brought out the highest voter turnout in years as young French voters were urged to come out to defeat extremists. Leaders of the newly formed leftist New Popular Front also joined mass protests against the rise of the far right, vowing a complete break with Macron's policies. This is Mathilde Panot, head of France Unbowed, speaking from Paris last month.
La mobilisation populaire est clé pour
popular mobilization is the key to fight against the extreme right and to beat the extreme right. We say regularly that the European elections mark the after Macron period.
Macron stunned France, calling on for the snap elections following major losses in European Parliament elections last month to the far-right National Rally Party. The RN has announced 28-year-old Jordan Bardella as its candidate for prime minister. The party's steadily risen in popularity across France as it backs anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist and anti-Muslim policies. It's also been accused of anti-Semitism. Many have urged parties to unite against the RN as the second round of the elections is scheduled for Sunday, July 7th. For more, we go to Paris, where we're joined by Harrison Stettler, a freelance journalist and teacher. His latest piece for Jacobin is titled Corporate France is Making Peace with Marine Le Pen. Welcome to Democracy Now, Harrison. Can you start off by just describing what took place?
Yeah, of course. Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me on. I mean, first off, I wish I could say that these results were surprising, were not to be expected. I mean, in electoral politics, you somewhat can occasionally be expect to have pleasant surprises in elections. This, unfortunately, is what many people in France have seen coming for several weeks from the day that Emmanuel Macron made the shocking decision in early June to dissolve the National Assembly on the backs of what was a historic victory for the National Rally in the European elections, as you presented in your introduction. The gut reaction on the ground in Paris, in political circles here, in the mainstream media, there's the impression one has is a certain sense of vertigo across the board. I mean, the headline of Le Monde today, the front page cover of Le Monde today, is the far right is on the doorstep of power, and it seems like that says it all. I mean, this has been building for many weeks. The decision to dissolve Parliament is going to, by Macron a few weeks ago, is going to occupy many analysts for many years to come. What was Macron really thinking? Was it a long-shot attempt to reinforce himself? Was it a cynical ploy to perhaps introduce the far right to power, if only to weaken it? That is going to be resolved by historians and whatnot. But now what is clear is that this decision was timed at a moment when the far right was at its strongest historical position in modern French political history. And they've capitalized on that. They've sailed in the momentum of the European elections into a strong first-place finish. You said, yes, 33.5% of the vote, according to the latest statistics that I've seen of yesterday's first-round vote in these legislative elections. But really, I mean, those figures are, as a percentage, that can maybe be cause for some perhaps undue relief. I mean, 33, that's a third. There are two-thirds of the French electorate that are therefore still opposed. I mean, if you even really dig into these numbers, the upwards of 10.5, according to the latest figures I've seen, 10.5 million people who voted for Marine Le Pen's party under the list of Jordan Bardella, the official president of the National Rally, something like 10.6, according to the latest figures for the first round of votes. That's more than about 6 or 7 million voters compared to the legislative elections in 2022, when the party won something like 4.2 million votes. It's just an enormous, enormous surge in 2 years' time for a party that relatively recently was considered beyond the pale of legitimacy and acceptability in French politics. I mean, much of the rhetoric of French political culture in the late 20th, early 21st century. Obviously, one can question the sincerity of it, but much of the rhetoric of French politics up until very, very recently, and we should perhaps discuss this shift, was about projecting the far right as the one unacceptable alternative to legitimate Republican politics.
So talk about who Marine Le Pen is, of course, who inherited what was known what as the National Front from her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. This is a whole family affair, right? It's her nephew-in-law, that's Jordan Bardella, who would be the prime minister if the NR wins.
Right, right. So Marine Le Pen took over control of the National Rally about 10 years ago in the early 2010s before, as you mentioned, this far-right force was founded by her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, in the early 1970s. And in the early 1970s, up until really the Marine Le Pen era, this was the bête noire of French political life. It was a party that brought together skinheads, neo-fascists, a lot of hard-right conservatives in southern France, but specifically people who were mostly driven by obviously staunch opposition to immigration, and a party that traced its roots back to sort of nostalgics of the Vichy regime, hard-right French people who just never accepted the defeats of France and the Algerian War of Independence, early 1960s. So this was sort of the bête noire of French political life were these forces. In the early 2010s, Marine Le Pen, when she took over the reins of her party, I mean the constant framing of the Marine Le Pen shift in the early 2010s is that she moved to the term the French use is to de-diabolize the. What was then called the National Front in 2019, she changed the name to the Rassemblement National, which means the National Rally. And so the main narrative of the Le Pen years, and obviously this narrative leaves out all the continuity over the transfer between Jean-Marie Le Pen and Marine Le Pen. But the main narrative of the last 10 years of the National Rally's history or the National Front's history is Marine Le Pen's attempt to detoxify the party. She actually moved to expel her father a few years ago on account of further outrageous Holocaust denying claims that he made. And her broad strategy to do this has been to try to present a force that is more or less capable of government, can be amenable to traditional conservative elites. On the other hand, you had an attempt by Marine Le Pen in the 2010s to mark somewhat of a shift from sort of the original economic positions of the far right National Rally, which in her father's years was essentially the French version of Reaganism, whereas much of the traditional center right up until the 2000s had an at least rhetorical support for the French welfare state, defending certain sort of social institutions that maintained the peace between businesses and workers. The original National Front was very much sort of alleged to be the defender of sort of the small entrepreneur against big business in collusion with state actors. And Marine Le Pen orchestrated a shift towards a sort of more workerist, economic populist position, which in recent weeks actually has essentially been dropped out of the arena. And what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is the party essentially prepares itself for a likely position of government from perhaps next week is that it is reshoring itself of many of the sort of economic populist positions that Le Pen long held in an attempt to impress or assuage the concerns of many figures in the French corporate community.
We only have a minute or two left, and I wanted to ask about the closing the borders, anti-immigrant mantra of this party. And also, I mean, when you have a close second of the left, if the left were to combine with Macron's forces, the center, which were trounced, that would certainly beat out the far right. Is that a possibility in this July 7th final election?
Of course, to respond to the first question, I mean, if there's been shifts back to the original pro-business planks of the far right, what it has clung to absolutely is its staunchly xenophobic rejection of immigration. We're going to see an attempt, if they're in power, in a position to govern, an attempt to fully accelerate and expedite the process for expulsion of immigrants in France, zero tolerance policies, attempts to institute a firm division between French nationals and non-French nationals, even between French nationals and binational French citizens, people who have a second passport. So the party is there's more that connects it to its past than that distinguishes it. Just one of the second question, which really is the question over the next specifically 24 hours, but mostly until Sunday, is what are the other political forces going to do in this situation? I mean, the National Rally and the faction of the center-right that they're allied with are in a very commanding position, are in first place in the majority of runoffs for next Sunday. And what can the other forces do? I mean, to the left's credit, the New Popular Front Alliance, they have put out a very fair offer, a very reasonable proposition to withdraw all left-wing candidates from districts in which the left-wing candidate qualified for the second round runoff, but is in third place behind another figure of either Macron's bloc, the Macronist centrist coalition, or the wing of the center-right that did not ally with Le Pen. So the left has made it very clear that they are willing to move to reconstitute something along the lines of what the French of the last several decades have called the Republican Front against the far right. Now, if you look to what's happening in the Macronist center, you're getting anything but clarity in that regard. You have Macron put out a very sort of vague sentence about the desire to have a Democratic and Republican alliance. You hear some figures say that, yes, they will pull out from certain districts, certain constituencies, when the alternate candidates in second or first place ahead of them against the National Rally is someone that they deem Republican enough and respectful enough.
Just to be clear on that point, you have the leftist New Popular Front saying their candidates would stand down if they were in third place, came out. You know, there were like 300 candidates. Macron's coalition has not yet stated their candidates would step down if they were in third place.
Right. You're hearing mixed signals. You have an acknowledgement of a willingness on Macron's part, yes, to withdraw candidacies. Again, what Macron's communication and what the center-right's communication is that France Insoumise, the dominant force in the left-wing New Popular Front Alliance, is essentially as dangerous as Le Pen. I mean, this is little has done more harm to France's political debate than this equivalency drawn between the left-wing France Insoumise and Marine Le Pen. And over the next week, we're going to see the degree to which that will hamstring any attempts to build some form of Republican Front alliance to block the far right. But for much of the French political class, for much of the mainstream media organizations, and for many pundits that will do the rounds on television networks or that will be signing many of the columns in weekly magazines over the next week, They will have this line of the far left, France Insoumise, is an anti-Semitic force, is an equal threat to Republican order, and it's an extremely dangerous equivalency that it's drawn, and it's really something that touches to, I think, the core of. The broad cultural and political shifts that have led us to this point where we are today with the far right in a very strong position and reasonably confident of potentially winning an absolute majority, or at least being in a position to form a relative majority and have potentially a minority government from next week.
Harrison Stettler, independent journalist and teacher based in Paris. His latest piece for Jacobin, Corporate France is Making Peace with Marine Le Pen. Up next, Power Grab. We'll look at the Chevron decision and more of the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us.